From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email SundayHouseCall at CFRA.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 360 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, long distance number 1-800-580-2372. All our lines are open. Looking forward to speaking with you today. It is a scorcher, and I hope you're enjoying the day in the pool or doing something to cool yourself off. I don't know if some of you heard a conversation we had on Wednesday with Anna Drahovsel, and she brought up the ad campaign in the United States by the California Milk Processor Board. They're one of the groups that have used the Got Milk campaign and such. And there's a campaign on now claiming that drinking milk will help reduce the incidence of premenstrual syndrome, or PMS, for women. And it's doing this in a way that uses it as how it affects their partners or men. And so in this case, you know, I'm looking at an ad right now. This is a man with a confused look on his face holding two cartons of milk in his hands. And it says, I'm sorry for the thing or things I did or didn't do. And it has at the bottom a little caption saying milk can help reduce the symptoms of PMS. And for more information, to go to everythingidoiswrong.org. Now, I don't know about you, and I'd like to get your opinion about this, but if you had an ad campaign about how milk could help cure your depression, I'm sure you would start asking lots of questions about that. And if you started to further say, well, how this depression affects the spouses in a humorous way, that is, oh, everything I'm saying or doing, you're snapping at me, you're being irritable, I don't know what to do anymore, I don't think you'd find that too funny. And I don't find this particular campaign funny at all for several reasons. One is I think it belittles women, and it holds them somehow blames them for their condition and then how it affects their partners. When really, premenstrual dysmorphic disorder, as it's called now, is a very real condition. It's what we call an endogenously produced depression. That's cyclical, in that hormone cycles directly affect chemical compounds in the brain, hence affecting brain function. And you see this happen every month as a cycle changes. Some women are not affected by this at all, and others go through absolute misery, wherein they can have several weeks of severe mood swings, inability to sleep, no motivation to do anything, complete loss of interest in all the activities that they used to enjoy doing, withdrawal from socialization and having difficulty focusing and concentrating. In effect, all the symptoms you would normally associate with severe depression. And then once their periods start, the symptoms tend to disappear and they return to a normal functioning state. The problem is that during that normal functioning state, they're worried about the next, you know, 2 weeks, 2-3 weeks later, when the whole process starts all over again. It's like looking at this sentence that you have to repeat over and over and over again. And so from that aspect, I find making light of this quite injurious to women. I'm sure it doesn't make anybody feel much better to see this kind of ad campaign. And secondly, the studies and the claim that is being made that somehow if you drink milk, it'll improve things are coming from studies that are very old. One of them is from the Archives of Internal Medicine that was published back in 2005 that really didn't look at milk at all. It looked at vitamin D and calcium intake from a variety of foods. And they found that those women that had the greatest intake of those, some of them had a lowered likelihood of having premenstrual dysmorphic disorder. But in addition, some of the older studies also cited used calcium supplements and not milk at all to demonstrate that calcium can lower the incidence of this particular condition. But the problem was, in a lot of these studies, it was almost a crapshoot, because you had about 55% of women who responded positively when they had vitamin D and calcium, but 45% of them really didn't. So again, not a huge difference in terms of the effect it has. There was likely some other factors, other circumstances that were not controlled for in these particular studies. So the relationship is tenuous at best. And I'm really wondering why these ads were allowed to go on. Not necessarily, you know, in the United States, the Federal Trade Commission, which oversees these things, usually looks at the claims. They're not really looking at the content of, in this case, you know, the everythingidoiswrong.org, but rather the claim that the milk itself is helpful to reduce PMS, and they haven't really done very much. But then, and this is from the Boston Globe, and I'm quoting from this, and this is the U.S. government: the government didn't take any action against this commercial, implying that your bones will get so brittle if you don't drink enough milk that your arms will shatter and fall off, or the celebrity-laden Body by Milk campaign that promises teens killer bodies if they drink milk. That's based on a study showing that teens who drink milk tend to be thinner than their sugar soda drinking peers. But I wonder how they compare to their friends who opt for calorie-free water, which wasn't addressed in the study. So you see a lot of these type of ad campaigns that tend to hang a particular variable or a particular food as the be-all and end-all of curing a condition. And ladies and gentlemen, there is no such thing in the world for any instance of a particular compound being the magic bullet for any disease. It's usually a combination of things that we do that all work together to promote better health, such as eating real food, avoiding processed foods, exercising regularly, not smoking, keeping your weight down, and on it goes. So I'm very disappointed to see this kind of thing in the news, this kind of ad campaign. Again, I think it's demeaning to women. I think it's sexist. And I think it even makes it more difficult for women to come for help when this kind of thing is made light of. I appreciate your opinions on this. If you'd like to bring this up and talk about this, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. I'm Dr. Barry DeWorken. You're listening to Sunday House Call. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry DeWorken. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Dr. Barry DeWorken, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Talk 521-8255, star 580 on Bill Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we're going to go to line one, and good afternoon to Sherry in Ottawa.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Not too bad, thank you.
Sherry, you have to turn your radio off.
Okay.
All right, there we go.
Okay.
That's much better.
Okay.
How can I help you today?
Okay, last Sunday, I was in the bathroom, and after a bowel movement, there was no blood in my stool, but there was blood on the toilet paper.
Okay.
And it was quite a bit of blood, and I don't have hemorrhoids. So I went to emergency at the Civic on Tuesday, and the doctor did a second-year resident did a rectal,
yes.
And he said, I don't have a fissure.
Okay.
And I have a family doctor, but I don't see her till the 29th for a colonoscopy.
Colonoscopy, okay.
Yeah, to get a referral.
Okay.
So I'm really worried if it's bowel cancer or not.
It's less likely to be bowel cancer if it is, if first of all, the stool wasn't stained, and as well, usually you tend to have more profuse bleeding, and not necessarily just when you wipe after a bowel movement. So it's not necessarily bowel cancer. You certainly do want to investigate. Usually a scope is much more effective at detecting fissures and internal hemorrhoids than a digital rectal exam is, because digital rectal exams aren't very helpful for a lot of things.
Yeah, I haven't had blood since on toilet paper.
Right, and that's an encouraging thing, because if there was any tumor that was bleeding, you would expect the bleeding to continue pretty much all the time, and so you would see blood on more than one occasion. A lot of times the skin itself, just from wiping, can sometimes get torn a little bit, or you get an abrasion, and that can cause a little bit of bleeding. But ultimately, whenever there's any bleeding, you do want to thoroughly evaluate the source for it. Another thing, there's a few other things that are done as well. Usually for people who have bleeding, intestinal bleeding as a result of tumors, they tend to have low ferritin levels or iron levels. Their hemoglobin can be a bit low because they're continually leaking blood throughout the day and every day. And so one of the tests that's also done is just a simple blood test to look at iron levels and hemoglobin. And that would also tell us if there was any regular bleeding going on.
Okay.
But ultimately, you know, doing a scope, having a gastroenterologist do the evaluation will tell you a lot more. They may find, as I said, internal hemorrhoids usually don't hurt, and they can be difficult to detect with a digital rectal exam. Fissures sometimes will cause some bleeding, but usually there's pain associated with fissures because they do tend to split and widen when you have a bowel movement, and that can be painful. So ultimately, with only one instance of blood noted on toilet paper, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that there's any cancer. Not with one instance of that only and nothing that followed afterwards.
Okay, then. And what if it happens again?
Well, the idea is, how do you treat this? And if a blood test is done and shows that your hemoglobin is normal, that you haven't lost very much iron, then even if you have one, two, three, or four more times where that happens, as long as your blood level is normal, there's nothing much to do other than the evaluation by the scope or by the gastroenterologist. There's really nothing else that you would do under that situation, because ultimately you're looking for the source of the bleeding. And the only way to find that source is to look. And the only way to look is usually, especially if it's inside the bowel, is by a scope.
Is it usually hemorrhoids, though?
Hemorrhoids is the most common cause. And you have two types of hemorrhoids. You have external hemorrhoids. Those are little bumps that you can feel on the outside. Those are usually quite painful. And you also have internal hemorrhoids, which are, as the name implies, they're inside. You can't really feel them. And also, they're not painful. They're above the line of where most of the nerve endings are, so you don't really feel very much pain with internal hemorrhoids. So,
okay.
So again, it's a straightforward manner to do the test in order to see if there's any blood loss. If there's none, then as well doing that colonoscopy in order to evaluate the colon itself to look for if there's any hemorrhoids or fissures or anything else that could lead to bleeding. But really, right now, what you likely are is what we call hemodynamically stable, meaning that you're not losing a lot of blood, your blood pressure is normal, your heart rate's not elevated, the blood test will tend to confirm that your hemoglobin is normal, the iron level is normal, and in those situations, it is a stable situation for you to be in that can certainly wait until that scope is done.
Okay, how about a polyp? Polyps?
You mean a polyp?
Yeah.
Polyps would be found on colonoscopy. Those can bleed sometimes, but usually polyps that bleed usually can be either early cancerous changes, sometimes precancerous changes. They will sometimes bleed, but a lot of times polyps don't bleed at all. And that's another good reason, especially when people approach the age of 50, to do a colonoscopy, because the fecal occult blood test, that's the stool test that people do to look for blood in it, does not tell you if you have any precancerous polyps, whereas a colonoscopy will find those polyps and they'll biopsy them. And a lot of times it's curative when you remove the polyps. So it's another reason for doing colon cancer screening, given how common colon cancer is in Canada, to actually do the screening You know, it's not the most pleasant type of screening test to have done, but it does save lots of lives.
So I could have a polyp then, eh?
It's possible, but it may not be what's causing any bleeding. That's the point. Polyps usually don't bleed. Usually the bleeding occurs when the polyp develops. If it is a precancerous change, when a polyp changes from a precancerous state to a cancerous state, that's when you tend to see bleeding. So it's I wouldn't hang or bet on a polyp as what's causing the bleeding that you're experiencing.
Okay, so would it be continual bleeding?
You would have, usually if you had a cancer where you had bleeding, you would tend to have continued bleeding and your blood test would tend to show that blood loss.
Okay, I understand.
Okay.
Now. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Sherry.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye now.
And we're going to go to line two and John in Orleans. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Dr. Dworkin, my
yes.
shoe pressed on the end of my big toenail.
Okay.
And then the big toe area around the nail is inflamed. Occasionally it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
There's some throbbing, but when I put ice cubes on it, it gets better.
Okay.
Now what do I do? Wait it out?
How many days has it been?
It started on Thursday evening. It was getting worse on Friday, bad yesterday, and it sort of stabilized today.
Okay. Now, it's the nail itself, did it lift up? Is that what happened? Is that what the type of trauma that happened? Or the nail got lifted up off the nail bed?
No, it didn't. It just pressed down. The nail was too long. It was my carelessness. It
oh, okay.
was too long.
Right.
And it just pressed at the end of the nail. And
okay.
then the cuticle, I guess, the area
right.
that goes into the flesh is where it began to hurt.
Yeah, it gets traumatized.
Yeah.
Well, ideally, what you want to evaluate with trauma to around the nail bed is whether there's any infection. And usually the signs of an infection are red. The skin gets red, it gets swollen, and sometimes you'll see discharge or even pus coming out from between where the nail meets the skin of the cuticle. You'll see discharge coming out of that area. If there's no discharge at all and it's just red and you find ice reduces the swelling and it feels better, this is something just to monitor. If, on the other hand, you're seeing fluid come out from underneath the nail or from the sides of the nail, that indicates more of an infection. And usually for infections, the simplest way to treat it, considering that it's localized, is to soak the toe in very hot water.
Salty?
It doesn't have to be salty.
Uh-huh.
And the reason hot water works is, and as hot as you can stand it, you don't want to scald your toe, but you want to make it very hot. And the reason is that the heat creates a local hot environment around the toe that is too much for bacteria to survive in. It's too hot for the bugs to actually live, and so it kills them off. And that's why the hot water around that toe will work very well if there's an infection. If there's no infection right now, if there's no discharge, and it seems to be stabilizing and now gradually getting better, I would just leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if you do see that it hurts and it's getting more red, or the red is starting to move down the toe a bit, soaking in hot water is not going to hurt it. Usually you do it for about 20 minutes at a time for about three times a day, and you try and keep that water as hot as possible over the 20 minutes, not to let the water cool down. But that usually will help if there is an infection. The only way to really know is to look at it. Hard over the radio to tell you that, John. But otherwise, if you're concerned that there's an infection starting, again, the hot water is not going to hurt the toe in this regard.
Fine. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, John.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And we're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we have Nancy in Ottawa who would like to talk about ocular rosacea. And Faith in Barrhaven has some questions about aspartame. 521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call. Star 580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. And if you have any opinions about that milk campaign in California that seems to belittle women about premenstrual syndrome, like to hear from you too. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Weekly. checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. And if I say I want to set you free, don't you know you'll be in misery?
Five, two, one, talk. 521-8255. We're just experimenting with some of the music, ladies and gentlemen. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to go to, line three, and Nancy in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I was diagnosed with ocular rosacea a little under 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And initially was having to bathe them twice a day and put Tobradex on them, mm-hmm. on the eyelids and so on, for a period of, I don't know, a couple of months or whatever that I went through that.
Right.
And on doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
But my eyelids itch.
Mm-hmm.
I was to see the specialist for a regular checkup, a little over a week ago. And he's more concerned with the rosacea, I guess, and I also was diagnosed with AMD a couple of years ago.
Okay.
So he's looking at that, I guess, but I said, well, my eyelids itch, and he said, well, he could give me something itching if it was in my eyes.
Right.
But not my eyelids. And when I mentioned it to my family doctor before, he said the only thing was systemic steroids, which I really don't want to do. So I try to ignore it 90% of the time, but it's pretty darn annoying. It's like it almost cracks in the corner of my eyes from the itching. And anyway, my husband and I wondered if it was an allergy, and asked the druggist last week, and she suggested that it sounded like an allergy to try Claritin. So I tried that since Tuesday, and I forgot to take it this morning, and it was more itchy, but it doesn't take the itch away completely. And I just wondered if you have any suggestion as to what there is available.
Yeah, there is actually. There are topical agents that you can use around the eye. The main thing with regards to applying, for example, a topical steroid cream or ointment to the eyelid is because the eyelid is so thin, you have to avoid using strong steroid creams because...
Danger of glaucoma?
Not really. It actually will thin out the skin even more. It can cause skin atrophy. And on the eyelid, you do not want to have skin atrophy. It's already thin enough to begin with.
That's right.
But that being said, there are topical steroids that are what we call non-fluorinated. It's the fluorinated steroids that are the ones that are much stronger that you have to be very careful with in terms of how long you apply them. But there are much weaker steroid ointments and creams that... when you sparingly, just on the area that you find is cracked or itchy, because you said it's in the corner, right, where that happens?
Well, my eyelids are kind of itchy overall, but it's mainly like right in the very corners on the outsides and on the insides. But on the outside, it's kind of almost like a crack in skin, as if it was in between your toes, crack in the skin.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that's can be quite annoying.
It's very itchy.
So what I would suggest it is. Ideally, you want to always start, in this case, because it's the eyelid, with the weakest type of topical steroid first. It may not work, but you don't want to move up the scale and use something too strong, which may actually cause some damage. So usually, you use either just regular hydrocortisone cream, anywhere between 1% or 2.5% hydrocortisone. And ideally, you want to use an ointment, because an ointment moisturizes, whereas a cream will dry things out. So creams are usually used for areas of the body that are already moist or wet to begin with, whereas ointments are used on areas of the body that are dry, where the skin is very dry, because it adds some extra to it.
Yeah, well, I have some lotion that is a cortisone lotion that, because I also developed a bit of psoriasis in my scalp.
Right.
So I haven't used that on my eyelids. But the Tobradex I was using initially, and my doctor said, well, that can cause glaucoma even...
Yeah, you don't, a topical, so, Tobradex is tobramycin, and there's also, I think it's...
I don't need to add that to my problem.
Yeah, you don't want to use, ocular steroid drops are very specific, used for very specific conditions. There are also eye drops for inflammation that are anti-inflammatory in nature, and those that can be used fairly safely because they do not cause glaucoma. It's not a steroid.
Oh.
And that's actually used to treat inflammatory conditions of the eye.
Really?
Some of them are... There's a few of them. Your family doctor would know of a few of them. I don't want to give any specific brand names to favor one or another.
But they are by prescription?
But they are by prescription. They are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory eye drops.
Okay.
And that can help the inside of the eye anyway.
Right.
And for the eyelid itself, if it just says hydrocortisone on that bottle that you have,
yes,
you can apply a little bit on the eyelid.
It's ectosone. I think it's ectosone. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's called ectosone.
Yeah, just if you look and see what it actually, it has to give you on the label, it'll tell you what it's contained in that. But I believe that is hydrocortisone, 2.5% is the ectosone.
Okay.
And just take a little bit on your pinky finger and just rub a tiny bit over the area that's cracked and do that twice a day, 2-3 times a day.
Oh, okay.
And again, keep it away from going into the eye. But if you're using it very sparingly, that should be fine. And again, you're using it just to the point where it heals up and the itchiness goes away, and then you stop applying it.
Well, what the specialist suggested, and I did try, was because I said, well, I'm afraid to use the Tobradex often, so when I get desperate, maybe every couple of weeks I'd put it on. And he said, well, try it for 5 days in a row or a week, and then stop for a month, for 3 weeks. He said sometimes just zapping it will do it, but that really, I tried that and it didn't work.
It didn't do anything. Yeah, I would try again the topical anti-inflammatory eye drops, and also start off with, again, just the weak cortisone. You can always then move up, and again, your family doctor has the whole list of, you know, all the different ointments that go up in terms of strength. There are, you know, I believe it's 7 different categories of strengths for steroids, going from very low potency to extremely high potency.
But again, at least
it gives you some options on what you can do. There's even for itchiness, sometimes what will help, there are also antihistamine eye drops. So instead of taking the Claritin, which is a systemic effect, you can use the eye drops, which stay local around the eye, and that may help the eyelids. Even though you're putting the drop in the eye itself, it may absorb through the eyelid a little bit and give you some antihistamine effect. And those work very effectively as well.
Are they over the counter?
Those are prescription as well.
Oh, they're prescription also. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm seeing my doctor the next 10 days, so I will ask him about these things.
Right. So at least you have a few things that you can try
options
and sort of mix and match and see if that helps you out.
Yes. Well, I really appreciate that.
Oh,
nobody else has given me any kind of a clue.
All right. Well, you're very welcome, Nancy. I hope that helps.
I do, too. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Right. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. And we're going to go to line 4 and Faith in Barrhaven. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. pardon me, I don't have a question about aspartame. I just picked up a copy of this, what's the name of it? The ones that are all at the bus stops.
Oh, the Metro thing.
Epoch Times.
Okay.
And they have an article in there, and the headline says, formaldehyde officially listed as cancer-causing.
Right.
And then it says, consuming aspartame increases formaldehyde exposure. And they say they haven't had any long-term subjects. This is one of my pet peeves, medical articles in newspapers.
Right. Well, Faith, you're right to be outraged about that kind of article. The formaldehyde.
No, it says, while long-term studies of the effects of aspartame have not been performed on humans, they have been done on animals. And then they go on and they say, while in Canada the intake of 40 milligrams of aspartame per kilogram of body weight per day is considered safe, an increased risk in cancer was seen in rats consuming just half of this amount.
Right. So in other words, rats consuming the equivalent of 40 cans of cola a day were shown to have cancer changes.
Yeah.
So if you can drink 40 a day, then you may see something happen. The point being is that the listing for formaldehyde as a potential cancer-causing agent was in reference to people who are working in factories that formaldehyde may be exposed at much greater doses. And
I understand all these things, but this is the frustrating part.
Yeah, it's
you know, and they finally summarize it by saying, consuming aspartame increases formaldehyde exposure for how formaldehyde causes cancer.
Right. So
my advice would be to avoid aspartame.
Yeah, well, they show their complete lack of understanding of how the body processes things. The formaldehyde angle to it is when the aspartame is broken down, the body, in terms of intermediary steps to break it finally down to and get rid of it, formaldehyde may be formed in parts per billion in your body, but it doesn't last very long because it's gone in several seconds. So it doesn't really matter as it's broken down. So the same thing can be said for alcohol. When you drink alcohol, when your body uses your enzyme system, alcohol dehydrogenase converts alcohol, it'll convert it into other compounds like acetone and other things for very brief moments as your liver breaks it down in the biochemical pathway, but you wouldn't say the alcohol, that components from the alcohol that you have that one drink from is going to cause cancer. I would submit to that person who wrote the article about aspartame that the boatloads of sugar that we consume is likely more harmful to someone than the milligrams of aspartame from time to time that someone may be exposed to.
Actually, it's written by Dr. John Briffa.
Well, I think the doctor...
And he's a London-based physician.
Right.
And, you know, this is what has people all worried about everything all the time because the newspapers exaggerate things so often. And I don't know what
well,
to be said about that.
I remember I had a conversation with Dr. Iona Pratt. She was the chief specialist in toxicology at the Food Safety Authority of Ireland, and she was also the chair of the European Food Safety Agency subgroup on food additives, flavorings, processing aids, and materials in contact with food. So this was had to deal with aspartame. And they had concluded that aspartame posed no risk to human health, and the long-term studies were such that the cutoff of 40 milligrams per kilo of body weight, which again is the equivalent of drinking 80 cans of soda with aspartame per day, I've yet to meet anybody that drinks 80 cans of soda a day. And if they did, it's not necessarily aspartame that would get them over time. It's the fluid overload that would probably hurt them because they'd be taking in too much water during the day. So, again, these kind of things and these kind of stories that you see in the paper, I'm really glad you brought that up, Faith, and that you had those questions and those conclusions because it's spot on. It's junk science reporting. That's exactly what that is.
But there's something like that in the paper almost every day, something that there is. If you have knowledge, any medical knowledge, and you read it, you realize that, you know, giving a rat half as much aspartame as a human is allowed, it's idiotic.
Yeah, and a lot of times they inject as opposed to eat it, and so you end up with a misrepresentation of what the compound does as well. So it's disheartening when you see articles like that, and the only thing we can do is to keep applying proper science to it and explaining why it's pseudoscience and why it doesn't work. But people are going to believe what they want to believe. Even when you explain things, some people won't believe you. So
yeah,
there
I guess
you
that's
go.
True.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Faith. Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break and back with your calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call and back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Disco when you need it. Yeah. 521-TALK. 521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility. And we are going to go to line two and say good afternoon to Joanne in Ottawa.
Oh, hi, doctor.
Hi.
I spoke to you about, I think about 6 months ago, but disease.
Yes.
At that time, they were kind of looking into it.
Right.
Now, 6 months later, I've gone through so many tests, I can't even begin. I'm sure you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it came right down to the wire where they actually took pictures of my face because it's a different shape, my stomach, et cetera.
Okay.
And they presented it in front of a board. That's how, I guess,
right,
close the decision was.
Mm-hmm.
So they gathered a board of endocrinologists, which,
right,
I can't say.
And endocrinologists, yeah.
And now it's come back that they're saying that it's not.
Not Cushing syndrome.
But to me, like, it seems so close. But other than that, is there anything else that you could think of that may cause the same symptoms?
Well, did they give you any other diagnosis? Because really,
not at all. Basically, go back to your family doctor and square one. Here we go again.
Well, do they think it's an endocrine problem?
No, she doesn't.
She doesn't.
But it's just so bizarre to me because they had at one point talked about pseudo Cushing's.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't mentioned to me at all. And I was in kind of shock when she said it wasn't because we were so sure, all
right,
of us, that it was.
Right. Well, usually what they will do is they will send a note back to your family doctor with recommendations about who to see next.
Oh, okay.
So there's usually, especially if it's gone through a board where they reviewed all of this.
Yeah.
They've probably reviewed all kinds of things more than what my level of expertise is in this area, right?
Okay.
Because they've really gone the extra mile for that to try and figure out what's going on. So I probably wouldn't be able to give you another answer as to what you might be having, primarily because I don't have all the information of what they did. So ultimately, it is going to be what's in that consult note that they send to your physician, which likely is going to be pretty thorough with regards to what they discussed and what they ruled out.
Okay.
And usually what they do provide is, okay, the next step would be to see this person or to do this particular test. They usually try to provide some differential diagnoses. So, unfortunately, Joanne, I wish I could tell you something more, but you've been through all the specialists, so that's...
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Doctor, you wouldn't
right.
believe it.
Right.
That's why when it came so close to the crunch, we were all shocked, including my doctor, I think.
Well, especially if you're expecting a particular diagnosis and it doesn't turn out to be that, then you're left holding the bag and saying, okay, well, what is it? Yeah.
Disappointed because I didn't have to have brain surgery. Now, how ridiculous is that?
Well, it's good that you don't need to have brain surgery.
There's always a positive.
Right.
Well, okay,
Joanne, let us know.
Much.
You're very welcome. Let us know what happens with regards to, you know, what their ultimate conclusion was once
you
get that information.
Okay, I will.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. We're going to go to line one. And Peter, good afternoon. Peter, are you there?
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I hear you say my name.
Yes.
Doctor.
Yes.
Now, one day I was walking to the store, and I got this tightening in my chest.
Okay.
Now, along with the tightening in my chest, I'm getting clear liquid that comes out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I've been doing is drinking a lot of milk. I thought it was just acid reflux or indigestion.
Okay.
So it seems to be helping.
But you're still getting the chest pain.
Not very severe, though. It only happened once severely. And every once in a while now, I'm getting chest pain. But it's more of a burning.
Okay.
Not really a tightening of the chest. It's more of a burning, like acid reflux or something.
Does this also tend to wake you up at night? Do you get this kind of... Okay. Are there specific times where it happens more often than others? Is it?
Well, not that I can be aware of, but I noticed as I've been kind of putting down the milk quite heavily,
mm-hmm.
it seems to relieve it.
So when you do, so when you have that burning and you consume, in this case, milk, it tends to make things, it relieves it a bit.
Yeah.
Now, does it come back an hour or two later? Do you notice?
It actually doesn't even happen every hour or two. It may happen mm-hmm. maybe three times a day.
Okay. And when did this start, when you started getting this kind of...
The actual tightening in the chest was about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. And are there any medical conditions that you have? Anything...
Well, right now I'm taking... valproic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the other one? Olanzapine.
Okay.
And I've had many different surgeries. The last was a hernia.
Okay. And how old are you?
59. Just had my birthday.
Okay. Is there any family history of heart disease? Or
My father, I believe.
He did, eh? And have you had cholesterol levels checked and blood sugar levels checked?
They were checked quite a long time ago, but I'm looking to the pharmacy now to get another check done.
Okay. What I would recommend is, ideally, whenever there's any chest pain, although it may be reflux, and there is a specific treatment for that, you want to also make sure that this is not cardiac in nature either.
Yes,
we don't want to miss the boat on that. So
Sure. The last time I had my checkup was about maybe 3-4 years ago.
Yeah.
And they did an ECG, and it was fine, I guess.
Yeah, but those aren't good to check for heart disease.
Okay.
They're only good to check if the heart is enlarged.
So what should I do now?
Well, ideally, the things to do are, you need to see your physician. You need to have cholesterol levels done. You have to have blood sugar levels done. With chest pain, your family doctor may want to send you
I don't have a family doctor. He retired.
Okay. Well, if you can go to any of the clinics at least to start.
Right.
And just say that you have chest pain. They may also do an exercise stress test to see if the chest pain is related to.
By the way, speaking of exercise, I have been kind of intensively exercising.
Okay. And do you get that chest pain when you do that?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay, so I would...
It's weird, because like, I get this clear fluid coming out of my mouth.
Right. Well, Peter, what I would recommend is probably to slow down on the intense exercise if you're getting that chest pain.
Right.
And you really need to have that checked out. So I would go this week and just say, look, I'm getting chest pain with exercise. There's a family history of heart disease in my father, and I need a cardiac evaluation done. You can always treat reflux, but I don't want you to miss the boat on the heart if it is the heart.
Okay.
All right.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Peter. Bye-bye now. My apologies to Bruce, Barry, and Brad. We have completely run out of time. It's been a very busy afternoon. My thanks to everyone who's called today, and your comments are always appreciated. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. Everyone, have a great week.